will not discuss it further. You, Mr. Chairman, may, if you will, call the next witness." At this point, the audience inside the hearing room broke into applause, and millions of Americans watching the proceedings from their living rooms saw McCarthy as the dangerous bully he was. By shaming McCarthy, Welch shamed America for having tolerated McCarthy and the communist witch hunt he was leading. That was the beginning of the end of McCarthy's reign of terror, and of America's paranoia about communist enemies within. A more recent example occurred in August 2017, after Donald Trump equated the neo-Nazis who marched on Charlottesville, Virginia, with counter-demonstrators there. In response to Trump's equivocation, Kenneth Frazier, the head of Merck Pharmaceuticals, resigned from Trump's Business Advisory Council, the first CEO to do so. Frazier said that, quote, "America's leaders must honor our fundamental values by clearly rejecting expressions of hatred, bigotry, and group supremacy, which run counter to the American ideal that all people are created equal. As CEO of Merck, and as a matter of personal conscience, I feel a responsibility to take a stand against intolerance and extremism," end quote. Frazier's words and action fortified other CEOs to follow him in resigning from Trump's advisory boards. Although Trump himself has shown no capacity for shame, their action had large symbolic importance. It signified that the corporate leaders of America were not going to abide white supremacists. They were going to take a stand for the ideal of racial equality. Shame may be in our genes, helping us survive. Charles Darwin, in his book The Expression of the Emotions in Man and Animals, noted that humans around the world express shame in similar ways. Blushing, becoming hot, casting their eyes downward, and lowering their heads. Shame may have evolved as a way to maintain social trust necessary for the survival of a group, and therefore of its members. In a 2012 paper, psychologists Matthew Feinberg and Dacher Keltner and sociologist Rob Willer found evidence that embarrassment, which often accompanies shame, functions socially as a kind of nonverbal apology for having done something that violates group norms. A display of embarrassment shows others that the embarrassed person is still aware of the group's expectations and is still committed to the group's well-being. But in modern America, we often shame the wrong people. Instead of deterring behavior that undermines the common good, shame is too often deployed against people who don't fit in, to ostracize them even further. That has happened on social media through cyberbullying. Even when it comes to truly shameful acts, the ability of anyone to use social media to accuse anyone else of committing them can have unfair and destructive consequences. After white supremacists marched on Charlottesville, onlookers shared hundreds of photos of them online. This form of shaming may have deterred some white supremacists from participating in future marches, but in this case, some people who hadn't been involved in the march were accused of marching because of their likeness to someone who had been. An assistant professor at the University of Arkansas School of Engineering, who resembled a white supremacist at the rally, was misidentified as a participant and received a torrent of threatening messages. If the common good is to be revived, shame must be used carefully and accurately. Even when the right people are shamed, there must be appropriate consequences. Members of Congress often make demonstrations of shaming CEOs who have harmed the common good, but they're typically no more than shaming rituals for the cameras. Hearings have been staged to berate CEOs of tobacco companies, oil companies, auto companies, Big Pharma, and Wall Street. Even Martin Shkreli and Wells Fargo's John Stumpf. But the scolding merely creates an illusion of accountability. After Shkreli's appearance, Congress didn't take action to prevent drug price gouging. After Stumpf appeared, Congress didn't pass legislation making it harder for banks to defraud their customers, and Stumpf was never prosecuted. When the carelessness of oil company BP on the North Slope led to the temporary shutdown of the nation's largest oil field in August 2006, Congress demanded BP executives appear in person to answer for it. Representative Joe Barton, a Texas Republican and vice chairman of the Committee on Energy and Commerce, excoriated them. "If one of the world's most successful oil companies can't do simple, basic maintenance needed to keep the Prudhoe Bay field operating safely, without interruption, maybe it shouldn't operate the pipeline," he fumed. "I'm even more concerned about BP's corporate culture of seeming indifference to safety and environmental issues. And this comes from a company that prides itself in their ads on protecting the environment. Shame! Shame! Shame!" Committee members grilled BP executives about why the company had failed to do adequate inspection and maintenance, and the BP executives solemnly promised to be more careful in the future. But no legislation was passed to force them to be. 4 years later, BP spilled 210 million gallons of oil into the Gulf of Mexico from its Deepwater Horizon drilling rig, the worst oil spill in history. If we're serious about restoring the common good, congressional shaming must be followed by legislation and criminal prosecutions that confirm the standard of behavior we expect. Such criminal investigations must be directed against individual wrongdoers rather than at companies as a whole. Corporations cannot feel shame. Only individuals can. There's not much shame being associated with a large corporation that gets slapped with a fine. There can be a great deal of shame in personally going to jail. Yet these days, few executives of major corporations and Wall Street banks are ever held personally accountable for illegal acts. As I've noted, no executive of any major bank was prosecuted for causing the 2008 financial crisis. This was not for lack of evidence. Goldman Sachs clearly misled its clients by betting against the same financial products it was peddling to them, to take but one example. Obama's Justice Department stopped bringing cases against corporate executives because, as ProPublica's Jesse Eisinger found, winning cases against individual executives has become too difficult and expensive for government prosecutors. Corporations have become adept at giving their top guns plausible deniability of knowledge in any nefarious scheme. Goldman executives use the abbreviation LDL, Let's Discuss Live, to hide their traces. And prosecutors are routinely outgunned and outmaneuvered by platoons of high-priced corporate attorneys. Young government prosecutors who want lucrative partnerships in prestigious law firms when they leave government often don't want to jeopardize their career prospects, so they go easy on individual executives. They view the executives as good people who have done one bad thing. As one SEC lawyer who was reluctant to bring charges against individual executives explained to Eisinger, "It's often more convenient for prosecutors to give government a PR victory by slapping corporations with a fine, ultimately paid for by shareholders, and making them promise to behave better in the future." But individuals, not corporations, must be held accountable for undermining the common good. That is where the shame is. And shame is what is in short supply. In recent years, America has become confused about the difference between private morality and public morality. Private morality concerns what people do in private, often involving sex, sex between unmarried people or gay people, adultery, contraception, abortion, gay marriage, even which bathroom a transgendered person must use. Public morality involves what people do when they hold positions of power and public trust. Some Americans object to women deciding to have an abortion, to gay people marrying, or to transgender people choosing a bathroom different from the gender on their birth certificate. I happen to believe that intimate decisions like these should be left to these people rather than decided by government. But however you come out on private moral choices, there is little doubt that the nation is experiencing a significant crisis in public morality. When executives of pharmaceutical companies gouge consumers by jacking up the prices of drugs as high as possible, bank executives defraud their depositors by opening up sham accounts, and presidents denigrate the press, seem to endorse white supremacists, and disregard conflicts of financial interest, they are all engaging in acts of public immorality. They are rejecting the common good in favor of their own selfish needs for more wealth or power. This is shameful. Some years ago, William Bennett, scourge of personal immorality when and after he was Secretary of Education under Ronald Reagan, railed at Americans for being, quote, less willing than we once were to sacrifice or to keep commitments, end quote. He said average people place a higher value than ever before on, quote, personal growth, self-expression, and self-discovery, end quote. He accused the nation of adopting a, quote, deeply ingrained philosophy that glorifies freedom from constraints, end quote. Bennett's target was sexual license, but I think his words are more relevant to the whatever-it-takes creed that has overtaken American leadership. Part of what it means to be a morally responsible human is to act in ways that are sometimes contrary to our natural instincts, Bennett wrote. We struggle against our biological impulses, against our emotional longings. We do not abjure the struggle because it's difficult or because we seem to be battling against something deep within us, even if it seems fundamental to who we are. In other words, using Bennett's logic, but applying it to public rather than private morality, unconstrained desire for wealth and power is not to be excused just because it's part of human nature. All people, especially those who occupy positions of leadership and are entrusted with the well-being of many other people, should be held to a higher standard. Respecting private morality does not, however, mean licensing sexual harassment and predation by the rich and powerful. That, too, is shameful. Yet society all too often ends up honoring such people while overlooking their abuses of power. In 2017, the Los Angeles Press Club honored movie mogul Harvey Weinstein by bestowing on him its Truth Teller Award for contributions to the public discourse and cultural enlightenment of our society. The organization called him an example of, quote, integrity and social responsibility, end quote. While Weinstein distributed some laudable films, he also had a long history of harassing and abusing women in five-star hotel rooms. Apparently, this was an open secret in Hollywood. Personal disclosure, Weinstein once distributed a film I co-created, but I did not know about his history of harassment until it was widely reported in October 2017. Why did Hollywood honor Weinstein despite this open secret? In part, because Weinstein raised money for many activities Hollywood approved of, including the presidential candidacy of Hillary Clinton. He also had the power to make and break careers, not just of starlets, but also of an ecosystem of writers, journalists, and public relations specialists who directly or indirectly depended on him. As Rebecca Traister wrote in New York Magazine's The Cut, quote, there were so many journalists on his payroll, working as consultants on movie projects or as screenwriters or for his magazine, end quote, that they shielded him from exposure and dared not sound the alarm. Shame on him. And shame on them. Ideally, notions of right and wrong are sufficiently embedded in people's moral consciousness from an early age that they don't need to be honored or shamed into good behavior. The erosion of the common good over the past decades, however, suggests that such moral consciousness has waned. Society must buttress it, and in so doing, remind others of acceptable limits. Maintaining limits is a way of asserting community, sociologist James Q. Wilson has written. If the limits are asserted weakly, uncertainly, or apologetically, their effects must certainly be weaker than if they are asserted boldly, confidently, and persuasively. Setting limits isn't simply a matter of making and enforcing laws, because as I've emphasized, clever lawyers can almost always find ways to skirt the letter of the law. When Donald Trump said he didn't pay taxes because he was smart, he meant that his tax attorneys had found legal ways to circumvent the tax code. Setting the kind of limits society depends on requires public moral judgment. Just as we shouldn't be reluctant to celebrate behavior that exemplifies public morality, we shouldn't be reticent in condemning behavior that undermines it. Faith-based leaders have a unique responsibility and opportunity here, quite apart from whatever religious tenets they might hold or preach about private morality. They can help society distinguish private from public morality. They can also call for a public morality that rejects whatever it takes strategies for amassing personal wealth or power in favor of one that stresses our duties to one another. Moral guidance about what is right or decent can be found both in religious teachings and in our contemporary understanding of what we owe one another as members of the same society. As I've suggested, they overlap. A public morality that protects our democratic institutions, cherishes the truth, accepts our differences, ensures equal rights and equal opportunity, and invites passionate engagement in our civic life, gives our own lives deeper meaning. It enlarges our capacities for attachment and love. It informs our sense of honor and shame. It equips us to be virtuous citizens. America still bestows lots of honors and wields heaps of shame, but they're too often disconnected from the moral basis of society. If we're serious about reestablishing the moral foundation of our life together, we must change how and whom we honor or shame, and reconnect these practices to the good we hold in common. And what we do in our own society should be a guide for what we do in the world. Chapter 9. Resurrecting Truth. Reviving the common good also depends on each of us taking responsibility for finding, sharing, and insisting upon public truth. By public truth, I mean facts about what is happening around us that could affect our well-being, as well as clear logic about the significance of those facts, and reasoned analysis about their practical consequences. Particular people have special responsibilities in this regard. We rely on scientists, researchers, professors, analysts, and journalists, in laboratories, universities, think tanks, government agencies, and in the media, to discover and report the truth. We depend on leaders of business, government, and nonprofits to relay the truth. We need fact-checkers, truth-tellers, whistleblowers, and investigative reporters to help us uncover the truth when we've been lied to. But in recent years, the tendency to do whatever it takes to gain wealth or power has undermined truth, and called into question all these roles and responsibilities. Even before Donald Trump became president, comedian Stephen Colbert joked that the statements of politicians only approximated the truth, truthiness, as he called it. The mainstream media, for their part, have occasionally slanted the news out of fear of offending major advertisers or powerful interests in government. New York Times reporter Judith Miller notoriously colluded with the George W. Bush administration in propagating its blatant lie about Saddam Hussein's supposed weapons of mass destruction. Meanwhile, journalists have been under mounting pressure to deliver stories that attract the largest number of viewers or readers, rather than inform readers and viewers of important truths. Corporate public relations professionals, who now vastly outnumber professional journalists, do whatever it takes to get favorable stories for their companies and avoid unfavorable ones. Because of ever-intensifying competition for funding, universities and nonprofit research institutions sometimes shape their research agendas to satisfy funders. Some even suppress analyses that funders dislike. All of this paved the way for Trump, his ubiquitous lies, his ongoing attacks on journalists, and his assault on scientists and researchers. They also served as a prelude to fake news, some of it coming from foreign sources intent on undermining trust in our democracy. We must not normalize public lying. The common good requires vigilance against it and the summoning of public shame when we find it. It is a central obligation of politicians, as well as journalists, researchers, scientists, and academicians, to inform the public of the truth and to identify lies without fear of retribution. It is the civic responsibility of all of us to check the facts we read or hear, to find and depend upon reliable sources, to share the truth with others, and hold accountable those who lie to us or suppress the truth. We must also ensure that every American has sufficient education to differentiate truth from falsehood, and to think critically about what they read and see. As I'll explain shortly, public education is not just a private investment. It's a public good. Yet that good is eroding. In 2016, one out of every four Americans believed the sun rotates around the earth. A third did not believe in evolution. A third did not accept the reality of global warming. And even among those who did, many did not believe humans are at least partly responsible. Without a shared truth, democratic deliberation is impossible. The only way we can understand the true dimensions of the problems we face together is with accurate facts about them, from sources the public trusts, along with logical assessment of those facts. As Daniel Patrick Moynihan once said, everyone is entitled to their own opinions, but not their own facts. He might have added that everyone is entitled to their own interpretations, but not their own logic. When we accept lies as facts, or illogic as logic, we lose the shared reality necessary to tackle our common problems. We become powerless. The challenge of reviving trust in the sources of truth is especially difficult in an era of raging inequality, when big money can suppress truth and buy off criticism. Our democracy is directly imperiled when the rich buy off politicians, but no less endangered when the rich buy off the institutions our democracy depends on to research, investigate, expose, and mobilize action against what is occurring. David Koch's $23 million of donations to public television earned him positions on the boards of two prominent public broadcasting stations. These positions also helped ensure that a documentary critical of Koch and his brother Charles, called Citizen Koch, did not air on public television. The documentary, about the secretive political spending by the Koch brothers as well as other wealthy individuals, was to be broadcast on PBS stations nationwide. Its funding was abruptly cut off when, it appears, Koch was offended by it. Or consider Google's financial power to marshal the facts it wants the public to know and suppress those it doesn't. Some background. Google's search engine runs two-thirds of all searches in the United States and 90% in Europe. Such a platform monopoly can squelch innovation if, for example, Google favored in searches its own services, such as Google Maps and Google Shopping, which is one reason why the European Commission hit Google with a record €2.42 billion fine in June 2017. Why hasn't Google run into similar problems with antitrust authorities in the United States? It almost did in 2012 when the Federal Trade Commission's Bureau of Competition recommended that the commission sue Google for conduct that, quote, has resulted and will result in real harm to innovation, end quote. The commissioners decided not to pursue the case and gave no explanation for their decision. As a former official of the commission, I can tell you it's highly unusual for the commissioners to decide against a staff recommendation without comment. Their decision may have had to do with Google's political clout. Google is among the largest corporate lobbyists in the United States and a major campaign donor to Democrats, who then controlled the White House and the Senate. Google also has enough financial power to stifle criticism coming from independent researchers. In September 2017, the New York Times reported that the New America Foundation, an influential center-left think tank, fired researcher Barry Lin, a sharp critic of platform monopolies like Google's. Lin had posted a congratulatory note to European officials on their Google decision and called for American antitrust officials to follow suit. Since its founding in 1999, the New America Foundation had received more than $21 million from Google and its parent company, Alphabet, and from the family foundation of Eric Schmidt, the executive chairman of Alphabet, who previously served as chairman of New America's board. According to the Times, Schmidt didn't like Lin's comments and communicated his displeasure to the president of the New America Foundation. She then accused Lin of, quote, imperiling the institution as a whole, end quote, and fired him and his staff. What really imperils the New America Foundation is firings such as this one, which distort its mission and undermine its credibility. Google also pays off academics to help sway public opinion and policymakers in its favor. In late 2017, the Wall Street Journal reported that Google has quietly financed hundreds of professors at universities such as Harvard and Berkeley to write research papers that help Google defend itself against regulatory challenges to its market dominance, paying $5,000 to $400,000 on a wish list of topics. Google has used the resulting research in courtrooms, regulatory hearings, and congressional hearings. Some professors have allowed Google to see the papers before they're published, enabling Google to offer, quote, suggestions, end quote, according to emails obtained by the journal. The professors' research papers do not disclose that Google sought them out and don't necessarily reveal Google's backing. Trump's shoot the messenger war on truth-telling institutions has been an extension of all this. When opinion polls have shown Trump with low approval ratings, he has attacked the polling industry, asserting that, quote, any negative polls are fake news, end quote. When government researchers and scientists have come up with facts that contradict positions Trump has taken, he has criticized the researchers and scientists. When as a candidate, Trump didn't like the positive employment numbers from the Bureau of Labor Statistics showing the economy improving under the Obama administration, he called the official unemployment rate a phony number. When the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimated that large numbers of Americans would lose their health insurance coverage as a result of the plan the Republicans were then promoting to repeal the Affordable Care Act, Trump's press secretary warned that the Congressional Budget Office could not be trusted to come up with accurate numbers. when Trump disagreed with a judicial finding that his original travel ban was intended to prevent Muslims from entering the United States, he called the judge who made the finding a, quote, so-called judge, and attacked the appellate judges who upheld it as, quote, so political they weren't able to read a statement and do what's right, end quote. Trump and his administration have drummed up evidence to support positions they want to take, suppressed government data that doesn't back up their positions, and removed fact finders who won't cooperate. When Trump couldn't find evidence to support his claim that 3 to 5 million fraudulent votes were cast for Hillary Clinton in the 2016 election, he created a commission to find such evidence. When the academic members of the Environmental Protection Agency's Board of Scientific Counselors, the outside advisory committee that reviews the work of scientists within the agency, found that climate change was a reality, the EPA did not renew their membership. An EPA spokesman said they would be replaced by industry experts who better understand the impact of regulations on the regulated community. In September 2017, the Treasury Department removed from its website a 2012 economic analysis showing that when corporations are taxed, only a small portion of the tax's final cost is paid by workers, while most falls on shareholders. The analysis contradicted Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin's argument that a corporate tax cut would mostly benefit workers. A spokeswoman from the department explained, quote, the paper was a dated staff analysis from the previous administration. It does not represent our current thinking and analysis, end quote. Several weeks after Hurricane Maria devastated Puerto Rico, as Trump tweeted that the federal government was doing a great job restoring the island, the Federal Emergency Management Agency removed data from its website showing that half of Puerto Ricans still did not have access to drinking water and only 5% had electricity. We cannot be effective citizens in a democracy if truths unfavorable to those with power are suppressed, while lies favorable to them are offered as truth. If a cabinet secretary finds fault with an analysis done by a prior administration, he or she has a responsibility to explain to the public what those faults are. If an agency removes data that had been available to the public, the agency must explain why. Political leaders who disparage legitimate truth-telling institutions or hide the truth from the public are committing acts of intellectual treason. They're undermining our democracy. Perpetrators must be revealed and shamed. The same standard of truth-telling must apply to the private and non-profit sectors, and to universities. Think tanks that suppress research their funders don't like should no longer be entitled to a tax exemption, and their subsequent research reports should give notice that they selectively report the truth. Academics who accept money from corporations or other groups with financial stakes in the outcomes of their research must disclose the sources of their funding in all their resulting papers and in all subsequent testimony. Universities must not accept any funding that restricts the range of research they do. Guarding the freedom and independence of the press is also essential to maintaining truth as a common good. As Thomas Jefferson wrote from Paris to Edward Carrington, whom Jefferson sent as a delegate to the Continental Congress from 1786 to 1788, the best way to ensure a responsive government is to give citizens, quote, full information of their affairs through the channel of the public papers, and to contrive that those papers should penetrate the whole mass of the people. Were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter. But I should mean that every man should receive those papers and be capable of reading them, end quote. Yet 230 years later, the press's freedom and independence are under siege, and a growing segment of the public no longer trusts the major media. Distrust was on the rise even before Trump. On the eve of the 2016 presidential election, only 18% of Americans said they trusted national news media, according to the Pew Research Center. In a Gallup poll at about the same time, nearly two-thirds of Americans believed the mainstream press was filled with fake news. Contrast this with American opinion almost five decades before. In 1972, in the wake of investigative reporting that revealed truths about Vietnam and Nixon's Watergate scandal, 72% of Americans expressed trust and confidence in the press. The precipitous decline can be attributed partly to the media's increasing willingness to do whatever it takes to maximize profits. Most large media corporations are moved by shareholder returns, not the common good. In order to generate high profits and share prices, they have to attract consumers rather than serve citizens. This has transformed journalists from investigators and analysts offering serious news to content providers competing for attention. Broadcast media are obsessed by ratings. A Harvard study found that in the 2008 presidential election, the major TV networks devoted a total of 220 minutes to reporting candidates' positions on issues of public policy. 4 years later, the networks allocated 114 minutes to policy. In 2016, they devoted 32 minutes. Hillary Clinton's policy ideas and proposals received almost no attention, while her emails commanded 100 minutes of airtime. Meanwhile, Donald Trump's antics ruled the airwaves. His eagerness to vilify, disparage, denounce, and defame others, not just Clinton, but also President Obama, Mexican Americans, Muslims, new immigrants, other nations, especially China, Democrats, other Republicans, and the press, turned him into a magnet for readers and viewers, and not just on Fox News. Regardless of whether they were appalled or thrilled by his diatribes, they were entertained. Schooled in reality television and New York tabloids, Trump has known how to drive ratings. Notwithstanding his attacks on the media, top media executives have been delighted. As the 2016 presidential race heated up, Leslie Moonves, CEO of CBS, said the Trump phenomenon may not be good for America, but it's damn good for CBS, adding, "Who would have expected the ride we're all having right now? The money's rolling in, and this is fun. I've never seen anything like this, and this is going to be a very good year for us. Sorry, it's a terrible thing to say, but bring it on, Donald. Keep going." No wonder Trump received more coverage than any presidential candidate in American history. As president, he has continued to dominate the news for much the same reasons. Moonves knew his admission was, quote, a terrible thing to say, end quote, because he was aware that the common good required a different response, and probably less coverage of Trump. The Communications Act of 1934, which continues to be the charter for broadcast television, recognizes its responsibility to the common good, requiring that licensees serve, quote, the public interest, convenience, and necessity, end quote. I wouldn't want government to intrude on CBS News' editorial judgment about how much to cover Trump or any other candidate, but the act signals that CBS and the other major networks have a responsibility to the public that transcends their ratings. At the least, network news divisions should be independent of top executives who represent the interests of shareholders. This was the case before the 1980s, before the corporate transformation I outlined, when the news divisions of America's three major broadcast networks made decisions based not on how much profit they generated, but on what an informed public needed to know. Former CBS correspondent Marvin Kalb remembers CBS's owner and chairman, William Paley, telling news reporters in the 1960s, "I have Jack Benny to make money." Now, however, the owners and major investors in broadcast television demand that their news divisions make money. This evolution paved the way not only for Trump's dominance of the news cycle after becoming president, but also his ongoing assaults on journalists. "The most dishonest human beings on earth," as he's called them. "The lowest forms of life. Scum. Sick. Purveyors of fake news. And the enemy of the people." Even suggesting that their goal was to remove him from office. "They have their own agenda. It's not your agenda. It's not the country's agenda." The harangues have scored points with Trump's base and served to discredit anything the press discovers that could damage him, but at the expense of a weakened democracy. If a large enough portion of the public comes to trust Trump's words more than they do the media's, Trump can get away with saying and doing whatever he wants. When that happens, democracy ends. The debasement of the press has sometimes led to violence. On the eve of his election to the House of Representatives, Montana Republican candidate Greg Gianforte beat up Ben Jacobs, a reporter for the Guardian newspaper. The violence was prompted by Jacobs asking Gianforte for his reaction to the Congressional Budget Office's report showing that the House Republican substitute for the Affordable Care Act would result in 23 million Americans losing their health insurance. At that point, in the words of a Fox News team member who witnessed the attack, Gianforte grabbed Jacobs by the neck with both hands and slammed him into the ground behind him. Gianforte then began punching the reporter. As Gianforte moved on top of Jacobs, he began yelling something to the effect of, "I'm sick and tired of this." Jacobs scrambled to his knees and said something about his glasses being broken. To be clear, at no point did any of us who witnessed this assault see Jacobs show any form of physical aggression toward Gianforte, who left the area after giving statements to local sheriff's deputies. Gianforte's attack on Jacobs was shameful enough. Almost as shameful was Gianforte's press release about what occurred, which blamed Jacobs. Quote, "It's unfortunate that this aggressive behavior from a liberal journalist created this scene at our campaign volunteer barbecue." End quote. It was a blatant lie, as evinced by the Fox News team and the charge against Gianforte. Under Trump, though, blatant lying has become the new normal, and a liberal journalist, the enemy. Gianforte was elected and allowed to take his seat in Congress. He is now known as the Honorable Greg Gianforte, but there is nothing honorable about his behavior. Kathleen Hall Jamieson, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania, said that Trump, quote, "has contributed to a climate of discourse consistent with assaulting a reporter for asking an inconvenient question," end quote. Whether you agree or disagree with Donald Trump's policies, all of us must stand up against this. It is the road to despotism. Even had there been no disparaging comments or threats by Trump and other politicians, the media would still need to rebuild public trust. Print and broadcast news outlets must demonstrate to the public that their news stories are produced accurately and intelligently. They need codes of ethics with clearly stated processes for checking facts and correcting errors, and ways to ensure that the public is made aware of such corrections. They must clearly separate facts and analysis from opinions and advocacy, and inform readers and viewers of any news or news gathering that's funded by organizations with a stake in what's reported. They need ombudsmen to investigate public complaints about their coverage, along with public editors who serve as paid in-house critics. These steps are necessary not only to rebuild public trust, but also to restore the media to its rightful place in our democracy and protect the truth as a common good. At one time, I believed that social media would democratize the news, enabling more people to become truth-tellers, give more of us access to a greater range of stories and perspectives, and provide a useful alternative to corporate media. I was wrong. Instead, social media has enshrouded all of us in cocoons of our own making. We're too easily tyrannized by algorithms that feed us only the facts, analyses, and opinions we already favor. We no longer live in a common reality, but rather a reality shared only with those who already agree with us. We're also clustering geographically, choosing to live around people who share our values. In 2016, 8 out of 10 U.S. counties voted overwhelmingly for either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. I believe it is our responsibility to break out of these self-generated bubbles. We need to seek alternative sources of news and information that don't merely confirm our biases and preconceptions, and test our views by seeking out people with different views and opinions. I'm sure I still remain largely in my own bubble, but I make an effort to break out. I read daily editorials and comments in the Wall Street Journal, as well as the New York Times, the National Review, as well as the American Prospect, the Weekly Standard, and the Nation. I try to make a point of exchanging views with conservatives and Republicans. I almost always accept speaking invitations from universities in red states. I still have a long way to go, but I sincerely believe, and I tell my students, that the best way to learn anything is to talk with someone who disagrees with you. The ease with which just about anyone can post anything on the Internet and gain a following poses another danger to the truth. All you need is a smartphone to photograph or video in real time, and you can create your own fake virtual newsroom. With a bit more effort, you can spread lies to millions of people by using algorithm-friendly headlines and search-optimized keyword bombs. You can deploy millions of bots to move a fake news article to the top of Facebook trending topics or Google search. If you can afford it, you can hire a data mining firm to discover and aggregate personal information on tens of millions of people, uncovering their concerns and biases, thereby enabling you to give them custom-tailored news and ads designed to exploit these emotions. In this new world, truth can be doctored to meet anyone's needs. According to BuzzFeed, during the final 3 months of the 2016 presidential campaign, the top-performing fake election news stories on Facebook generated more engagement than the top stories from major news outlets such as the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Huffington Post, and NBC News. The dilemma is how to police against this and whom to trust with the policing. Should we give Facebook, Google, and giant servers like Cloudflare the responsibility? Or should we expect the government to assume this role? In a free society, where exactly is the border between fake news and dissent, and who should decide? I don't have any simple answers to these questions, but here too, I think each of us has a critical role to play. We have a responsibility to educate ourselves and others about how to find the truth, and how to assess the news we receive thoughtfully and critically. We need to learn better how to recognize lies so we can refrain from sharing them and warn others. We need to demand that the leaders of news-gathering organizations, not just print and broadcast media, but also giant tech companies like Facebook, Google, and Twitter, understand their role as trustees of the common good and take appropriate steps to guard the truth. As I've said, we should honor truth-tellers, whistleblowers, investigative reporters, and courageous public servants who tell us what we need to know rather than what we want to know. And we should shame the liars and truth-suppressors, those who use their wealth, power, and positions of authority to mislead the public. We should also prevent data mining bots from exploiting our private biases and concerns, as revealed on the Internet, to flood us with custom-tailored news and ads. The way to do this is to make our personal information private. There's no good reason why data about everything we view or buy on the Internet, as well as everything we read or see and where we travel, should be available to anyone other than ourselves. This information is not a common good. To the contrary, it is private. But to make it private, we will need a law that prevents Facebook, Google, data mining firms, and other potential aggregators of personal information from using it. As citizens, I believe we have an obligation to push for such a law. Chapter 10. Civic Education for All. Finally, and not least, restoring the common good requires a new commitment to civic education as part of the formal education of children and young people, as well as the ongoing education of us all. Our children need to understand themselves not just as individuals seeking self-expression and lucrative careers, but also as citizens responsible for upholding our core common values. They need to learn to respect, but also reform, the major institutions of our society. They should be equipped to deliberate with others over what is best for our society and the world, and to civilly and respectfully disagree. When I heard John F. Kennedy's adjuration that we ask what we can do for our nation, I was attending a small public high school in upstate New York. Part of the required curriculum was called citizenship education. It involved a series of courses on history and government. As in most schools, some were well taught while others were taught abysmally. I remember one teacher who often pointed to a world map showing the Soviet Union, China, and most of Eastern Europe in bright red, with surrounding nations in pink. Her ongoing civics lesson was that communism was spreading like an infectious disease. If we weren't careful, what remained of the free world would catch it. Civic education in the 1950s reflected many of the prejudices of the day. Yet, it at least engaged us, day after day, in the practice of thinking about the well-being of our society and the world. The ongoing examination of history and our system of government had a cumulative effect. Regardless of our politics, we began to see ourselves as the inheritors of an important legacy. That legacy was far from perfect, but it was profoundly important. We had an obligation to become responsible citizens. Civic education was long ago eliminated from the standard high school curriculum. In its place has come a narrowed focus on English and math, along with an avalanche of tests. At the same time, higher education has become ever more vocational. Students crowd into courses on economics and business or computer engineering. All told, education is now viewed mainly as a private investment rather than a public good. This is understandable. As I've noted, with inequalities of income and wealth wider than they have been in over a century, parents and their children face the daunting possibilities of unprecedented riches for those with the right education, or squalor for those on the losing track. What you learn is what you'll earn, as the popular saying goes. Over his or her lifetime, the typical high school dropout will accumulate no more than half the earnings of a high school graduate, while the typical college graduate will earn twice as much as someone with only a high school degree. Yet if education is simply a private investment, yielding private returns, there's no reason why anyone other than the investor should pay for it. No wonder increasing numbers of parents resist paying for the education of other children, especially those who are poorer or require extra teacher time and resources. The same attitude extends to legislatures that have been cutting funding for public universities. If a university degree is a private investment offering a good return to the individual, they argue, why should taxpayers bear the cost? It would seem more appropriate for students and their parents to take out loans to cover it, just as people borrow for all sorts of other worthwhile investments, such as a new home or business. Education, though, is not just a private investment. It's also a public good. America's founding fathers understood that our democracy depends on it. As historian Alan Taylor has observed, they knew emperors and kings could easily mislead uneducated publics. The survival of the founders' new republic necessitated a public wise enough to keep power within bounds. It required citizens capable of resolving the tension between private interests and the common good. People imbued, in the language of the time, with civic virtue. At the close of the Constitutional Convention of 1787, a woman was said to have asked Benjamin Franklin what sort of government the delegates had created for the people. He replied, "A republic, if you can keep it." What did keeping it require? More than anything else, education. "Ignorance and despotism seem made for each other," Jefferson warned. But if the new nation could enlighten the people generally, tyranny and the oppressions of mind and body will vanish like evil spirits at the dawn of day. During the colonial era, a few towns ran public grammar schools, but only for a few weeks in the winter when family farms didn't require their children's labor. Other towns relied on private tuition. After the Revolution, reformers pushed for free public education. Jedediah Peck of upstate New York typified the reform movement. "In all countries where education is confined to a few people," he warned, "we always find arbitrary governments and abject slavery." Peck persuaded the New York legislature to create a comprehensive system of public education. The person most credited with founding American public schooling, Massachusetts educator Horace Mann, also linked public education to democracy. "A republican form of government without intelligence in the people," he wrote, "must be, on a vast scale, what a madhouse without superintendent or keepers would be on a small one." Mann believed it important that public schools educate all children together, in common. The mix of ethnicities, races, and social classes in the same schools would help children learn the habits and attitudes of citizenship. His project was not without fault. It emphasized Protestantism over Catholicism, for example, which was one reason Catholics created their own private schools. The goal of inculcating public morality extended through higher education as well. Charles W. Eliot, who became president of Harvard in 1869, believed, "The best solution to the problem of national order lay in the education of individuals to the ideals of service, stewardship, and cooperation." If the common good is to be restored, education must be reconnected to these public moral roots. We must stop thinking about it solely as a private investment that may lead to a good-paying job, and revive the founders' understanding of it as a public good that helps train young people in responsible citizenship. This requires that schools focus not just on building skills, but also on teaching civic obligations. For starters, every child should gain an understanding of our political system, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, separation of powers, checks and balances, and federalism. They must understand the meaning and importance of the rule of law and why no one should be above it. And they need to know where these legacies came from and why they continue to be important. This is what we demand of people who want to become naturalized citizens. Immigrants have to pass a civics test covering the organization of the U.S. government and American history. When I served as Secretary of Labor, I had the privilege of administering the Pledge of Allegiance to some of those who had passed that test and witnessed their pride and gratitude in being welcomed into citizenship. Every child must also understand the difference between how our system should work and how it actually works, and why we all have an obligation to seek to bridge that gap, which means they must grasp the meaning and importance of justice, of equal political rights and equal economic opportunity, and how these two goals are related. They need to see how the economy is organized, how its rules are made, and what groups and interests have the most influence in making those rules.